From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about the history of mental health care in Milwaukee and how it has changed over the decades. Then we'll learn what St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Milwaukee is made of.
The stone for the church came from, primarily from Basswood Island, just across the water from the Bayfield Peninsula.
Plus, we'll explore the world of ham radio and how the DIY networks began as an early form of social media.
In the same way that you might be curious about connecting with other people online, this was kind of a spin of the roulette wheel. You never knew who you were going to talk to, but you could have these conversations with interesting people all over the country and the world.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, so today we'll examine the history of mental health care in Milwaukee County. It seems no matter the time in our city's history, the need for quality mental health care and the challenges of providing it have remained constant. This is true for the Behavioral Health Division, which is deeply rooted in the area's history and can be traced back as far as the 1850s. To help lay out the history of mental health care in the Milwaukee area and how it's changed, I spoke with Jonathan Peel, the division's unofficial historian. So Behavioral Health Division is a pretty modern term, but to trace mental health care back to where we started seeing a presence here in Milwaukee, what year do we have to go to?
You'd go back into the 1850s. It was really 1852 that the board purchased a 160-acre Hendrick Gregg farm in Wauwatosa, and that is the same location where the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center is today. At the time, though, that was considered the county grounds. We still often refer to them as the county grounds, and over time, that included a regular medical hospital just to be able to treat patients with physical ailments, but it also extended to be able to treat patients with mental health conditions as well. And so in the first few years of the farm, even before 1860, there were 6 beds that were really reserved for people who were mentally ill.
6 doesn't sound like a lot, though, right?
I agree. Yeah. And part of the challenge was even how much room they had for people. So this was literally a farm. They were repurposing farmhouses or livestock facilities into patient areas. They were really, of course, not purpose-built for that, and so they had the challenge of having enough space. These are, frankly, the same challenges that modern cities, including Milwaukee, still struggle with today. And so you can actually follow a progression of 1860, they had 6 beds. 1865, they expanded to 22 beds for the mentally ill. And then you keep on marching forward until really a key date in 1880, when a dedicated hospital was built for people with mental illness, and in the first year they serviced 200 patients. So certainly the need was there, and it was just getting the infrastructure sufficiently in place to be able to address the need.
So with 1880, when Milwaukee County opens up a hospital officially, what was the title of this hospital, and how did these facilities serve individuals? And in general, how were patients referred to as? What was the landscape of mental health care?
Sure. In 1880, the Milwaukee County opened the Milwaukee County Insane Asylum. That was the language of the day, certainly not the language that we'd use today. In general, you'll hear me refer to it as a mental health facility. It ended up having several names even over those next few years. And at that time, they were treating any patients who had mental illness, whether the mental illness was acute or short-term or chronic, something that's life-term or maybe lifetime impacting. And so by 1888, Milwaukee County opened a second mental health hospital. And so the names did become divided, that there was a Milwaukee County Hospital for the Acutely Insane and a Milwaukee County Hospital for the Chronically Insane by 1888. Both these hospitals were within about a mile of each other. The chronic hospital was just north of Wisconsin Avenue. There isn't anything there today. It's part of the Milwaukee Regional Medical Complex, but not that original hospital being there today. And the hospital for those with acute conditions was built just north of Watertown Plank Road. That actually existed into the 1980s, and there are still a few remnants of the facilities, of the grounds surrounding that today.
So In this scape, we have the two facilities, one for short-term, one for more long-term. And during this time, what does the model of therapy and care look like, especially for those long-term patients? Because we're starting to see more extensive buildings, grounds, so there's patients and staff working together. There's this you can tell me if it was a new concept at the time. Yeah. Industry therapy, it was referred to as?
Yep. So you've asked a question that has some complication to it. The chronic care facility, honestly, was just having patients inside of a room, keeping themselves and those around them safe. And I can't speak much more to the kind of care that was given at the time. It was really closer to incarceration than anything else, as compassionate of incarceration as there could be. And the patients were referred to at both facilities in those early years, the 1800s, as inmates. It wasn't necessarily pejorative, you know, like a prisoner or anything, but that was the term of art that they used at the time. Most of my research has to do with the acute care hospital and really the kind of care that was received there. And so in those acute conditions, the aspiration was that patients might be released within 3, 6, 9 months. And so that gives you a sense of what that short-term care could mean. There was also outpatient care, et cetera, and so it could even be a shorter timeline. But for those patients who would be there for 3, 6, 9 months, at the very beginning, the only kind of therapy that was given for women was continuous baths. And so none of the other things that we think about today, whether it be a chemical treatment or pharmaceutical treatment, that wouldn't have existed. And what they were left with was actually caring for patients with mental illness the same way we think about caring for babies today. And so if a baby is in some way distressed, often we'll give them a bath and be able to settle them down. Not my children. They hated baths, but some patients, of course, responded to that well. Similarly, they had something called packing tables. And so they would have a table with boards around the side of it, and then they would pack rolled towels around the patients so that they would really be swaddled. Again, the very same thing that we do with infants today. They would even alternate the temperature of the towels and things like that. But the treatment was, you know, very rudimentary. It was still much more compassionate and humane than a lot of the other treatments that were going on nationwide, and certainly anything that we were doing that preceded that, which again was just basically incarceration. Over the years, those treatments expanded. And one of the challenges was that patients, when they'd be released from the acute hospital, it was a revolving door. They might be back again in 6 or 9 months. And the challenge was that there's such a linkage between mental health, physical health, and financial health. And if all three of the legs of those stool weren't propped up, it wasn't enough to just release patients cured in their mental health. And so patients did have the opportunity to volunteer to engage in industrial therapy, what today we might call occupational therapy. They ended up receiving a small stipend, and they were able to work on the grounds of the hospital in a variety of different areas, everything from cooking or cleaning or tending the farm or doing landscaping work or learning some trades, horseshoeing or basket weaving or metalworking or other things like that.
So is that the model that is in place primarily from, say, the late 1800s to up to almost the mid-1900s? Like, is the 1940s and 50s kind of a point where we start seeing a shift or pattern?
You're exactly right. The 1940s and 1950s is when there was a pivot on some of that treatment. And it included that, just like today, the more extreme cases of poor care end up being sensationalized and they're what's in media. And people became more concerned that maybe the prisoners were being abused in this industrial therapy. They were being asked to do labor for what was a pittance amount of money and things like that. And so more rules, regulations, and even laws came into place to say, no, you can't be having patients doing this labor-type activity on the grounds. Certainly, that industrial therapy was well-intended when it was begun, and certainly in the 40s and 50s as that shifted, that was well-intended as well. There was a shift there then really to more recreational items, and so that included being able to do crafts, more with music therapy, more with being able to tend a greenhouse or being able to do bowling or learning social skills or things like that. So that's where that pivot took place. And then also in the 1950s is when pharmaceuticals really started to revolutionize the way that mentally ill patients were helped and treated.
In the late 60s, we have the Day Hospital here in Milwaukee that expands into the Milwaukee County Medical Health Complex. And this had a design of a, quote, non-institutional appearance, right? Is that also a new model that they're trying to expand this as a place to, you know, on the outside to try and help destigmatize the kinds of places people have to go to for care, but also hopefully have better outcomes for patients?
Every decade reflected an attempt to be able to improve the exact points that you've addressed. And the Day Hospital was a great example of that. It was called the Day Hospital because it was really outpatient treatment. Patients would come there for the day. Over time, they certainly also attached other longer-term care facilities where patients could be overnight, but then during the day, they would come to that portion of the hospital to be able to participate in all those things I just outlined. It did have the attempt to make it much less clinical and institutional. That building had an A-frame entry to it that was large, lush, with green plants and everything. Many parts of the hospitals had indoor atriums where you could go into a courtyard, so you at least were still outside, but you had the ability to go out and get fresh air and sunlight and things like that. And each one of the residential sections to that, or the inpatient sections to it, had their own outdoor, you know, fenced-in recreational area that had greenery and benches and things like that as well.
So here we are about the late 60s. How do things start to change in the 70s and 80s? And when does the debate of privatization start coming into play? Because this is still a Milwaukee County operation.
Sure.
We still face the same challenges today with county resources and debating on private. So when does that start coming into impacting healthcare and healthcare models?
So as I look at nearly every decade from 1850 on out, I can find newspaper articles that talk about the sensational failures where any kind of medical health care, including mental health care, have failed. And so those sensational articles, of course, get the more attention. And by the 1970s, it really had hit a tipping point for which the question was, are we as a public institution doing enough of the right things when these falling through the crack items still occur? And so the discussion really started in the early 70s about privatization. And there was a lot of dynamic tension about that for decades before the county started at least outsourcing portions of the mental health treatment. And then that process continued to be slow and steady over several decades to the point now where just about all of the mental health treatment for Milwaukee County that's provided for people who can't otherwise afford it is outsourced to third-party providers.
Okay. With keeping track of all these decades and all the work that you've done looking at this history, what do you think we've lost or gained in the current model of care today with all the shifts and changes, but yet those same themes of being under-resourced, understaffed, too many patients, not enough needs or facilities? I'm sure it plagues every single decade.
That's true. As I've done the research, I've really seen every 20 years almost a rediscovering of certain kinds of practices. And so I can see in 1910 that they're talking about music therapy that they've introduced for patients. And then I can find an article in the 1930s where they've introduced music therapy for the patients and it's all new and radical. And then I can go to 1950 and they're trying to fill a job position for a new music therapy department. And so there are cycles of where we approach something and then we lose that institutional memory about it and then end up doing it again. What's really admirable about the way that we treated patients, I would say from the 1880s through the 1940s, is that they had 60 acres to be able to go out and be able to be recreate in. And they were encouraged to be able to contribute to that space too. Maybe they would do gardening or they would do area improvement or tree trimming or things like that. But then when they were released, in addition to having treated their mental health issues, they may have also learned a skill along the way that helped them with their financial security in the future. And they might have been working their way up to how much they could do each day. So the first week they were there, maybe they'd be outside 2 hours a day doing some of that industrial therapy, working all the way up to 8 hours a day so that when they were released, they had improved their mental health state, they had gained a skill to be able to have a job, and they had the physical stamina to be able to go out and be able to contribute and compete in the work environment and keep that steady mental health state because all three of those legs had been shored up. I think that we still struggle today how to be able to shore up all three of those legs. And we have a regulatory environment that further limits our ability to touch on all those, in addition to levels of funding and staffing and other things that are limitations that we struggle with. And I believe we succeed still in some areas and still struggle with in some areas.
We've tried to condense a lot of decades of history of care here in Milwaukee, but what is the value in not just learning about, but in keeping this institutional memory and knowledge alive?
Being able to know where we came from, what has worked and what hasn't worked, really ought to be able to help inform us about what we can do in the future. We don't have to redo the learning curve every decade or with each new set of graduating doctors or things like that. And so being able to keep that history alive, I think, can inform, while the resources and the situation is different, because today the regulatory environment is different on a national level, on a state level, on a county level, et cetera. And so the same options aren't available today that might have been available 100 years ago. But nevertheless, I know that there are very well-intended doctors, administrators, leaders who are still trying to persevere through the current environment and be able to provide good, reliable, consistent mental health care for people, being informed by those past experiences. And so I know even as there's privatization today, there's still a lot of thoughtfulness to being able to create an environment that is less institutional, more warm, still has outdoor experiences, still has recreational experiences, still has art therapy and music therapy experiences, even in the midst of those other restrictions.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing some of this vast knowledge that you've acquired.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Jonathan Peel is the unofficial historian of the Behavioral Health Division here in Milwaukee. He joined me in 2023. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about Milwaukee's robust ham radio community. But first, we'll learn what gives the St. Paul's Episcopal Church its brownish-red color in our latest What Milwaukee is Made Of. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Anchoring Milwaukee's Yankee Hill neighborhood is the imposing St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Built in 1882, this church is listed in the National Register of Historic Places. But the building's story goes back about a billion years to a period of intense volcanic activity, when what is now North America was being ripped apart. The Lake Superior brownstone used for this church's outer exterior is an example of this period's aftermath. Raymond Wiggers, architectural geologist and author of Milwaukee and Stone and Clay, joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to discuss the building's hidden history for the latest episode of What Milwaukee is Made Of.
Ray, what is the main exterior of St. Paul's Episcopal Church made of?
Well, Sam, if you go by the church or walk by it, you'll notice that it's one of the most striking materials you'll see on any building in Milwaukee. It's a very dark red, burgundy to maroon-colored stone, and it's actually a sandstone made up of sand grains, and it's known generically to architects and builders as the Lake Superior brownstone.
And where and when did the Lake Superior brownstone originate?
Well, different parts of the Lake Superior brownstone originated in different places around the Lake Superior Basin. Some of it is quarried in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and some of it is or was quarried in northern Wisconsin in the Apostle Islands area. And probably a lot of our listeners have been to the Apostles at one point or another, where there is now a national lakeshore. But a lot of the islands just off the Bayfield Peninsula there, including Basswood Island, were sites of major quarries in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the stone for the church came from primarily from Basswood Island, just across the water from the Bayfield Peninsula.
And when the stone was forming, what was the earth like?
Actually, for a long time, geologists weren't sure how old the stone was because it lacks fossils and other characteristic features that make it easier to date. However, in recent times, there has been a new technique that allows you to determine the oldest a stone like this can be. And we know that this stone is at least, well, let's just say it's roughly about 1 billion, that's billion with a B, years old.
And what was the Earth like at this time, about a billion years ago?
It was not a very nice place, especially in what we now call North America. So what had happened recently before the sandstone was laid down as layers of sand was there had been what geologists call an episode of huge extensional tectonics. And what that means is North America was being stretched apart or pulled apart, and a great rift formed. And this rift actually had kind of a horseshoe shape, and it went all the way from at least Nebraska, all the way up through Minnesota and Lake Superior, down through the lower peninsula of Michigan, and it created this big area where a lot of magma from deep in the Earth's interior came welling up to the surface and erupting. And it didn't erupt as giant volcanoes like the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. These were like lava fountains that were spewing out over a long distance a lot of lava. It's been estimated to have been about 2 million cubic kilometers of lava came pouring out. Well, when that was done, that's when the sandstone formed over all that massive deposit of lava.
All of this is happening, this kind of violent volcanic activity is happening around a billion years ago. Was there any life on Earth yet?
Yes, there was. Once again, we're not exactly sure of all the details, but you had, at the very least, you had not only bacterial life at that point, but also algae had evolved. There are people who have speculated that perhaps the animal kingdom goes back that far, or even the plant kingdom does, or at least more advanced algae do, but we're not quite sure about that. But if you had been in northern Wisconsin or the Lake Superior region in that era, it would have been a much more barren landscape than it is now, certainly.
And are there aspects of the Lake Superior brownstone that reflect this especially violent period in Earth's history?
Yes, there are. So the sandstone actually was deposited after most of the lava had erupted, we think. But it actually filled in that low area because the rift had been created and there had been all that eruptive activity and the, you know, crust is stretched apart. So there was this low area for all the sandstone or the sand that made the sandstone to actually form in. And the sandstone came from the surrounding terrain of mostly older rocks and higher ground.
Gotcha. So the markings of this stone from this period are not necessarily from the volcanic activity itself, but how the landscape kind of filled in after this volcanic activity. Am I hearing you right?
Exactly. And so what you're seeing, if you go up to the side of the church and you look really carefully at the stone, you'll see lots of sand grains that are actually coated in hematite, which is basically iron oxide or rust, so they have that rusty red color. But you'll also see larger pebbles that were washed down from the highlands on the side of the rift.
Now, moving to more modern days and human history, how was this material quarried and how did it get to Milwaukee from Basswood Island up north?
Well, that's very interesting, Sam, because at the time when that red sandstone was first really recognized as making a very good building stone, their usual quarrying techniques were used where you could either blast or cut a rock face that was available, and you could excavate away the topsoil or whatever and get down to the stone. But up in the Bayfield area and up in the Apostle Islands area, there are many places where that red Lake Superior sandstone outcrops naturally. So it was something that was quite visible for a long time. One of the reasons at that particular time in the 1880s and the 1890s that it was quarried so much up there was that there was a similar stone out east that was quarried out in the Connecticut River Valley of New England in Massachusetts and Connecticut, known as the Portland Sandstone, that was all the rage. If you've ever been to New York City or Boston, you've seen a lot of brownstone neighborhoods that are made of that particular stone. So when similar stone was discovered up in northern Wisconsin and Michigan, people started quarrying it at once. And in those days, the rail network was just developing. So it was often cheaper. If you, for example, wanted to bring a load of stone down to the St. Paul's Church building project in Milwaukee, it was easier to ship it by lake, you know, by schooner rather than by rail networks. Now, later in the 1890s and later than that, when the rail networks were much better established, you have the stone being brought down by train.
Moving to the roof, we find another striking building material that has a bit of a story to it as well. What is this roofing tile made of?
Well, it's made of slate. That's the quick answer. And slate is a very classy and very traditional roofing material that has been used for hundreds and hundreds of years. I have not been able to find absolute proof of this, but the slate that's on the church, at least on portions of the roof, match a very distinctive slate that comes from Pennsylvania, and it's marketed as the Chapman slate, but it's actually known geologically as the Bushkill slate, and it is from eastern Pennsylvania, so it's definitely not from the Midwest.
And when did this slate originate in what is now eastern Pennsylvania?
The slate itself is a lot younger than the Lake Superior stone around it and below it. It dates to a period known as the Ordovician. So it's about 470, 460 million years old, something like that.
And if I remember correctly from earlier episodes, around this time at this location that this slate was being formed, what is now North America was closer to the equator, and a lot of it was covered by a shallow sea. Does that still apply here?
It does. And the slate, because it's a metamorphic rock, it originally formed as something else, and it was actually a type of rock known as shale and mudstone. And it actually formed from submarine avalanche deposits that came rolling down off the continent into what was then the ocean on the continental shelf. And eventually, over time, when there was continental collision later, it was hardened and compressed into this slate material, which is so wonderful for roofing tile and for a lot of other things as well.
Yeah. Well, you preempted my next question. I was going to ask, what makes this slate an attractive building material?
Well, slate is an amazing material because it has a particular property, geological property, called fissility. It's fissile. And that means that it splits along thin layers. And so if you crack it in the quarry, it'll actually form little pieces that look like roofing slate already. You don't have to cut them down further. And however, having said that, it's also very, very, enduring and quite hard. So it makes a good covering for a roof.
And now moving on to the building's architectural history, what is unique about the architectural style of this church?
Well, St. Paul's is one of Milwaukee's great examples of a wonderful style of architectural design that was very, very, very popular in the late 19th century in America, known as the Richardsonian Romanesque. And it's named for an architect who came up with the style, Henry Hobson Richardson. And Richardson had traveled in Europe, and he was very much enamored with the medieval European Romanesque style, which featured sort of squat columns and semicircular arches and kind of solid stone buildings with rough exteriors and all that. And he brought that home and actually made it into a very, very significant American style in its own right. And it's a style that geologists have to love because often Richardsonian Romanesque buildings are clad in stone and very beautiful stone, too.
And you mentioned he made it an American style. Are there aspects that make this style, you know, American as opposed to European?
I think it was Richardson's own idiosyncratic way of looking at what the medieval style had been. And I think it has a particularly robust, rugged look to it. And I think that that is something that was more characteristic of sort of the American psyche at the time.
Gotcha. And are there other Milwaukee buildings with this architectural style?
Oh, yes, there are. In fact, we've talked about one of them already, and it's the Pfister Hotel. But also my other favorite Richardsonian Romanesque building in town is the Old Federal Building on Wisconsin Avenue. Beautiful building.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect. Appreciate your time.
And Sam, thanks once again for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Raymond Wiggers, author of Milwaukee and Stone and Clay, a book about the architectural geology of Milwaukee buildings. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods for our series, What Milwaukee is Made Of. When radio first emerged, it was the Wild West of communication technology. Pioneers in the industry learned firsthand how to wrangle the power of this new tech and create the standards we know today. But there are still cowboys among us, DIY enthusiasts with a sizable community here in Milwaukee. They're known as hams, and they're keeping the art of ham radio alive and well. Journalist T. Krulos wrote about them in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
Tell us a bit about the origins of ham radio. When does it really pick up in the U.S.?
It kind of started right away in the early 1900s after radios became popular. People figured out that they could tap into those radio waves and could kind of set up a miniature radio station of their own so they could talk to other people around the world.
How does it work exactly? I know that they're on the radio. Of course, I'm somebody who is often on the radio. Mm-hmm. Do you need to have a setup in your home, or what is it?
Yeah, and the setups vary quite a bit. So everything from like a small portable unit that looks something like a walkie-talkie to a very elaborate home studio where you have all sorts of equipment and you'll have an antenna either on your roof or in sometimes like a miniature radio tower in your backyard that can be 30 feet tall or so.
Well, it seems like you also, you need a license. Is that right?
Yes. You do need a license to operate the equipment. And the most common is the novice level of license. There is like a more expert level that you can get, and you'll have access to bigger radio waves, further range. But you need to pass a pretty standard test to get your license.
Sure.
And then you're given a call sign, by the way.
a call sign being?
It's like a series of letters and numbers, you know, WA9CNA or something like that.
Yeah. So we have, of course, call letters ourselves here on the radio. Ours is WUWM. Every station has call letters. It's all very regimented.
Yes.
So you, before getting into this piece, you actually had some familiarity with ham radio through your grandfather, who was an enthusiast.
Yeah, I have a very fond memory of being a kid. I spent a lot of time, especially in the summer, at my grandparents' house. And my grandfather was a carpenter, so he built his own floor plan for his house. And he included a little room that's like a den, except he called it his ham shack. And he had a big recliner in that room. It was filled with equipment. And I have this fond memory of walking through the hallway, and I would hear this very distinct sound of my grandfather snoring because he had fallen asleep while talking on the radio, and this sort of staticky crackle of people talking in the background. So that was really his passion. He spent a lot of time and money into his hobby, and he would come home from work and talk until he fell asleep in his chair.
Was he part of a community like it seems we have here in Milwaukee?
I know that he went to like some meetups. There was like convention, conference type stuff that happens regularly. But I think, you know, like other hams, he really found the community on air. He enjoyed talking to people in the comfort of his home. And as I discovered when I went to the ham radio outlet store here in Milwaukee, there's a community of people who just enjoy talking to each other, and it's very much like an early form of social media. In the same way that you might be curious about connecting with other people online, this was kind of a spin of the roulette wheel. You never knew who you were going to talk to, but you could have these conversations with interesting people all over the country and the world.
What does that community look like here in Milwaukee today? You mentioned, of course, there is a store where you can get quite a bit of the equipment that you need to do ham radio.
Yeah, Ham Radio Outlet, it's great because it's more than just a store. It's out there on Good Hope Road, and it's very large, and they have some meeting room spaces. So in addition to buying the equipment, this is where local radio enthusiasts like to hang out and have meetings. You can get tested for your license at special events there. And, you know, they just talk about stuff, set up different equipment to try it out. So it's really like the heart of the ham radio community in the Milwaukee area.
Did you get a sense for how many people are really in the community, or is it a little bit ambiguous?
I think it is a little ambiguous as far as, you know, who has a license versus who's actively using one. But I found a site. So they said that there was about 14,000 people licensed in Wisconsin. I don't know how accurate and updated that information is, but I guess that kind of gives a ballpark.
Sure. So a chance to meet potentially 14,000 other people.
Yeah. And one of the clubs I talked to here in the area, they said they had about 100 active members. There's at least some people out there.
Which seems like that's kind of the point of it, right? There's always going to be someone out there.
Yeah.
If you're someone who's maybe listening right now going, I think I want to get into ham radio, what can they expect from this kind of hobby? What is the atmosphere like?
It's a great hobby for people who are technically minded, I would say. So if you like building electronics and figuring out how they work, this is going to be a really great hobby for you. If that sort of thing frustrates you easily, like me, it's probably maybe not the best, or maybe you just want to hang out with someone who is licensed and just get to talk to people rather than set everything up. But, you know, it can be pricey like any hobby. I think, you know, you can start out with a simple setup, but you want more and you want better equipment. So it starts to add up. But everyone that I talk to is very friendly. Of course, as with other hobbies where people are kind of aging out, they are hoping to reach out to younger people to carry this on. So I think they're very inviting to people who are interested in learning more. And, you know, you shouldn't be intimidated. There are instruction books and classes that can help you get up to speed pretty quickly.
All right. Well, T, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect once again and sharing your work.
Thank you.
T. Krulos is a local journalist whose piece on ham radio was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break, and then we'll speak with a Wisconsin writer about his new eco-thriller book. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Jeffrey Bolt spent 24 years working as an administrative law judge for Wisconsin. He's moved on to writing, releasing his first novel, Blue Lake, in 2022. Now his second novel, Big Lake Troubles, is out. Both books tackle environmental and climate issues. Bolt describes Big Lake Troubles as an eco-thriller with a legal case involving coal shipping on Lake Superior. Bolt joins WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, to talk about the novel.
So if you would, Jeffrey, let's dig into those characters. You've said that there's four key characters. I guess Camille doesn't figure in there, but talk about the four characters. And of course, we've met all of them in your previous book.
There are four main characters that we get inside the head of. Camille is another character who's a Unitarian minister and something of a free spirit. But the four that we get inside their heads are Jason Erickson, who's a former administrative judge. He's in his early 50s, and he's done environmental hearings. But as the story opens, he's grieving, and he's slightly traumatized from past experiences. He's currently dating Grace Clarkson, who's his contemporary and former law school classmate. More importantly for the story, she's the attorney who's representing some neighbors opposing a coal shipping plant in the fictional town of Lake Superior City, Wisconsin. Then on the other side of the case is Courtney. She's a tough corporate attorney. She represents the coal shipping company. She can be a bit sarcastic and maybe cynical, but she's had a tough life and she has her reasons. And then both sides are trying to get Earl Franks, who's a former attorney fresh out of prison, who's trying to get his life together. But he has a lot of relevant background knowledge about coal shipping and environmental law. And both sides are trying to get him to their team. So what I try to do in both of my novels is blend the sort of vibe of a legal thriller, or you could call it an eco-thriller, but with the personal stories of each of the characters. Some of the themes that I wanted to get to were what makes people engage both with each other and with other important concerns like the climate crisis. So the coal shipping case was sort of a scaffolding or vehicle for that. And I think it works in that there's a kind of an inherent drama, what's going to happen with every legal trial. And now there's a similar drama and urgency about what will happen with respect to the dramatic changes we've experienced with respect to the climate. Now, I've been traveling around doing events in the upper Midwest, and my first in Madison was shortly after the floods in Asheville. It was in the 50s in December when I was in Duluth and Superior, and I was just in Green Bay as the LA fires were raging. So, this really is a crisis and has a thriller-like urgency to it as well.
I think that is one of the compelling elements, watching the character's evolution even within a short period of time. And that point of what makes people engage and then how do they engage is so critical. You get a taste of that just in these characters. It makes you think about our own engagement as individuals and communities.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to accomplish. And, I think it is relevant to environmental cases. I did those traveling around Wisconsin for 25 years, and you have empathy for everyone when you're the neutral, and you try to your best to be fair. And like Jason, my character, I was an administrative law judge hearing primarily environmental cases. Everyone has their own approach to things, and with the climate crisis too. Some of us maybe don't fly to New Zealand, or others of us don't eat red meat, or some of us unfortunately deny the whole thing and advocate not doing things, which you also see happening. So it's everyone brings their own perspective, and what I try to do in my fiction is show respect to all those perspectives.
Has your approach to your broader subjects evolved from your first novel, Blue Lake, to this one? How do you see your style, your approach, are evolving?
Well, my first novel was my MFA thesis. So I had a cohort of professors looking at my every move and telling me sometimes conflicting things. They were great. I learned a lot of techniques, especially. But this one, I really felt confident that I knew some of those techniques and that I had some not unique, but maybe rare combination of background and the ability to tell a story that I felt very good about this book, actually. And the reviews have been good, too.
when we spoke last about your first novel, you mentioned that in your view, the stakes were high then. I think at that point we were talking about democracy, not just climate change and environmental issues, but our democracy itself. How are you feeling at this point?
Well, you know, there's certainly reason for concern. One of them being that President Trump, at least publicly, is kind of a climate change denier, and that he's received record donations from the fossil fuel industry. But there's also the concern of AI and data centers that are requiring just unprecedented amounts of energy. You know, I've read a number of books on coal and climate, and I've been getting a daily or weekly, I think it is, Google alert about that. And during the first couple of years, it was happening that coal plants were going offline. Just recently, three or four plants that have been scheduled to go offline are now staying in service to meet the needs of AI and data centers. You know, there's headwinds that we're facing. But I'm still optimistic, and that's in part while I'm writing these books that have environmental themes. You know, the U.S. over the last couple of years has made an unprecedented investment in solar and other clean, renewable sources of energy. And there are other investments that are aimed at targeting carbon emissions. For example, here in Madison, we have these very efficient new electric buses, that makes a difference. Or things like biodigesters with manure, I hope that is not going to be actively thwarted by the new administration. I hope that they will continue to let private industry make those investments. And then, you know, we have our own individual ability to make choices. We can support businesses that are actively looking toward the future and taking climate into account. And it's very unfortunate that people aren't more forward-looking. You know, it's hard to turn around a big ship, which is the U.S. economy and, you know, the world's reliance on dirty sources of power. But, you know, we've made a good start. So, yeah, I'm still hopeful.
So I've thought in reading the book, Jeffrey, that one of the points that really struck home with me is, again, trying to appreciate not only by someone else who doesn't share your views, who doesn't see the world the way you do, but what's contributing to that? How can you find pathways to discussion, right? So I was thinking, do you think if your book, as one example, and others, were presented to people who love to read, love novels, but may not gravitate to the environmental realm, if more people read this and discussed it, it would help break down some of those silos?
That's certainly a motivator and a hope that I have. You know, there are points of contact. That's one thing I did take from my career traveling around the state and getting to know the people and their concerns. You know, there's a fundamental hopefulness there by virtue of how many people do care. And I'm sure you've experienced that in your career as an environmental journalist, Susan. People care. And if we can somehow bring it down to the level, not of this divisive politics that's just so poisoning, where, you know, people actively try to do things that are bad for the climate. I don't know what they're thinking. I can't understand it myself, but somehow get it back to, we're all in this together, and we have one planet, and we need a plan to deal with what's obviously a serious crisis. I have a dear friend who was just here from LA and talking about people in his neighborhoods and others who are out of their homes, lost their homes. It was the same story in Asheville. And people had moved to Asheville, North Carolina, because they wanted to escape the climate, you know, and people are moving to Duluth. But, you know, the story is really that there's not a safe place. This is not a problem that we can keep ignoring. and put our heads in the sand decade after decade. My oldest daughter just had my first grandson, another very hopeful thing. The year that Allie, my daughter, was born was the hottest year on record, 1988. And people were having hearings in the US Senate then about what carbon emissions were doing to our climate. And so little has been done until very recently to really address that instead of just putting our heads in the sand.
Jeffrey Bolt is the author of Big Lake Troubles and Blue Lake. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz earlier this year. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grid Nunez joining me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Eddie Morales, Taryn Powell, and Jimmy Gutierrez from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valera Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Lake Effect is off on Monday for Memorial Day, but tune in at noon to hear an encore airing of our special Rock and Roll Poet, a retrospective of It's All Right Ma host and legendary radio man, Bob Reitman. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.